to Eurovision, a podcast series that explores the extractivist gaze of European institutions and policies as a way to look beyond these extractive practices to the possibility of thinking and doing otherwise. My name is Audrey Sanson, part of the artist duo Fraud.
With myself, Francisco Gallardo, and in our practice, we invested in building critical spatial literacy.
In this case, into the inscriptive operations of the EU's Critical Raw Materials Initiative. In our last episode, we considered how institutions such as ICAT are managing the extinction of the bluefin tuna, which is emptying the seas and leading to the forced displacement of fisherfolk, namely, that are traditionally living from the wildlife in those seas. And so in this episode, we consider how this resource depletion affects those communities as well as the wider infrastructures of extraction which they are a part of. And for this, we are delighted to be joined by Dr. Nishat Awan, who leads the research project Topological Atlas at TU Delft. Topological Atlas, which she will tell us more about, produces visual countergeographies that combine digital mapping and storytelling techniques with a participative approach attending to those who are at the margins of traditional geopolitical inquiry. So could you outline the research that you've been undertaking with Topological Atlas?
The research that we've been doing for the past few years investigates, I guess, the relationship between technologies of border security, which of course includes the kind of, let's say, the more obvious aspects such as walls, fences, drones, surveillance, but then also border securities understood as bureaucracies that produce borders. So thinking with systems of documentation and the kind of legal landscape of the border, and then how all of these together produce a border landscape, let's say, that includes the physical landscape, the geography, environment, and ecology, but also a kind of experience of crossing borders for those who are doing this without the kind of required papers. And that's really the point of view from which we are looking at the border. So in terms of, let's say, methods, we do a lot of field research, which means going to particular border spaces, talking to people, doing interviews, looking at, you know, what the border landscape is like, understanding the livelihoods around the border, which, you know, as they are being securitized and fences and walls are being built, the people who live next to the border are, of course, almost always cross-border communities. And so their lives are also being disrupted by these kinds of securitization practices that are happening ostensibly to stop the movement of people. And so we combine this sort of field research with digital methods of mapping and modeling in order somehow to challenge, let's say, the sort of evidentiary urge that there is in maps and map making. So an obvious example here is the kind of migration maps that you see in the popular press, even in some academic research, you know, with arrows all pointing towards Europe, you know, they ignore the kind of circulations that are happening in particular regions of the world, in Asia or on the African continent. So we're trying to sort of make maps that are less, let's say, looking from the point of view of the communities that are at the border and the people who are crossing the border, but then also sort of trying to, you know, acknowledge the fact that the border is produced through forms of fiction, right? So whether it's the fiction of the legal system, the idea of the fair legal system in Europe, or if we think in terms of mapping, then the remote sensing type technologies that are also used to produce the border, they produce a certain kind of gaze that, for example, removes local communities and those who are kind of dependent on easily moving across borders for trade, for living, to see families, etc. So we are using mapping and modeling really as a way to sort of produce maps that don't erase these other inhabitations of the border, let's say. So in terms of how this understanding of the border relates to economies of extraction, I suppose if we think about migration, we know that the journeys of undocumented migration are not linear in the sense that they don't go from A to B. They never were that easy. But I suppose what's happening now is that the journeys have somehow become endless or never ending because migration has become this kind of system of circulation. Somehow the racial production of contemporary borders is designed to keep people moving. And I think it's important to say here that it's not necessarily about keeping people out, although this is clearly, you know, a very brutal part of the same system, but to keep people moving, a system of circulation that includes deportation regimes, precarious lives, militarized borders that work together to create a kind of global underclass. And so the work that we have been doing thinks about this economy of the, let's say, the extraction of migrant labor that is dependent upon this particular form of circulation or of unsettlement of certain lives, and then how this somehow intersects with another kind of circulation, which is the largest scale circulations of extractive economies like those of resource extraction. So the project that we've been doing is kind of organized through a series of fieldwork sites. So we've really been following, let's say, one route from Pakistan that also Afghan people use as well. So from Pakistan towards Iran, through Turkey, and then towards Europe. And I suppose I use the word towards advisedly in the sense that most people never make it to Europe. We know this. So people stop along the way, they give up, they're deported, they die, unfortunately, or they stop along the way as well. So this is why we felt that it was important somehow to flip the perspective and start from the places where people were really starting their journeys.
I very much appreciate also how this project focuses on, for example, circulation rather than linear trajectory in a way, because of course it emphasizes how migration, as you so rightly put forward through this project, is a space of opportunity for extraction of labor, for example, amongst other things. And so these spaces of opportunity can only really be actualized through this sort of constant circulation, actually, and that really facilitates the extraction of labor from these populations that are moving. And also how this is then articulated with the wider circulation of goods is really interesting as well. I was wondering if you could explain how resource extraction in this case becomes really foregrounded, because of course there's an extraction of labor, but there's also resource extraction that is somehow a background to this circulation.
So one of the places where we've been working, let's say, for the past 3-4 years is in Pakistan. It's a city called Gwadar. It's on the Arabian Sea coast of Pakistan, very close to the Iranian border. And the reason we've been working there is that it is part of this kind of migration route. So a lot of people start in the Pakistani mega city of Karachi, which is kind of again, on the Arabian Sea coast, but more eastward near the border with India. And then they go along the border to Gwadar, from which they then sort of cross the Iranian border. So the Iranian border is around an hour and a half drive away. But this is also a place where two different kinds of circulations come together. And the other circulation is this large scale infrastructural logistical circulation. So Gwadar is in fact part of the Belt and Road Initiative that China is currently in the middle of producing, I guess we could say. So the Belt and Road Initiative is sometimes called the New Silk Road, is China's way of sort of reinstating, they say, old Silk Road through logistics, through infrastructure, through roads, rail, communications infrastructure, power plants, all sorts of things coming together to produce a landscape of power. I think that's the best way of describing it. The Belt and Road Initiative is a series of, let's say, horizontal bands across the globe. And there are very few areas where there is a kind of vertical link between these bands. So there's also Maritime Silk Road and two kind of northern land ones. And so the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor is one of the major, one of the most important vertical links within the BRI. It starts in Kashgar, which is in the Xinjiang province of China, which is also where the Uyghur population is. So we know all about those atrocities that are happening there. And then the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor ends in Gwadar, which has a deep seaport. So in the last let's say 20 years or so, the kind of developments that have been happening in Gowarda have really been focused on this kind of Chinese-led development. The port was actually not built as part of the BRI. It was there already, the deep sea port, because Gowarda has this kind of naturally deep harbour. But even when the port was built 20 years ago, it was built in the place which used to be the prime breeding grounds for prawns. So Gowarda is known for these really delicious prawns. So obviously the stocks of prawns has completely gone down because the port has been built on the breeding ground. But I think what's maybe more important is that on the one hand, of course, by building the port, there's, you know, they have to dredge the seafloor all the time. So that, of course, depletes fish stocks. But what's really important to think about here also is that because the port has been built and because there's this development happening because of the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, there's a level of securitization around the port and the sea as well that has meant that not only are the fish stocks depleting, but the fisherfolk, the mahigir, as we call them in Balochi, they are not able to stay on the sea because the Pakistan Navy is there telling them to move away from the port. So parts of the sea have been cordoned off. In Balochistan and Gowarda, there's been this very particular kind of artisanal fishing. So small-scale boats, they go out for the day or maybe a couple of days and then they come back. But since this kind of interest in Gowarda has grown through these large-scale development projects, large trawlers have appeared near the coast of Gowarda. So because of these large-scale fishing practices that are happening now with the trawlers, somehow a way of life is being lost. So the knowledge of the sea, the seasons, the fish, you know, this is slowly being lost because the fisherfolk can't make their livelihoods with fishing anymore. But the other thing I wanted to mention here in terms of extraction was the other big livelihood in a place like Gowarda, which is through the kind of oil, so the diesel that's coming in from Iran to Pakistan. So as we know, of course, Iran is under US sanctions, so they can't sell their oil very, very much, but it comes across the land border on the back of pickup trucks, even on the back of small motorcycles in these kind of blue barrels into Pakistan, and particularly in Gowarda. There is only one petrol station that's kind of, let's say, the official petrol station, and it never has any petrol to sell. And so everybody uses this kind of grey market oil that's coming from Iran. So again, this particular practice, you know, the whole of the region relies on it, from drivers to mechanics to, you know, people who sell the oil, people who use it. And yet, because of the Chinese interest in the area, which has meant that the border is being highly securitized, the oil smuggling is also being stopped. And this has huge consequences for people living in that area. On the one hand, as I said, it's the cross-border populations of people anyway have families across the border that they now cannot visit, but also this kind of livelihood is being disrupted. One little thing I would say here is that in Pakistan for a long time, a system of raatdari was in place. So raatdari are these kind of small, essentially pieces of paper that you can get if you are somebody who lives, I think is within 50 kilometers of the border. It means you can cross the border, both the Pakistan-Iran and the Pakistan-Afghanistan border without a passport or a visa. You can go for a few days and come back. That system, obviously, in relation to Afghanistan, was shut down after 9/11. And in Balochistan, it has still been going until quite recently. But because of developments that are happening around CPEC and the securitization of the border, the raatdari system has now been closed, which has massive consequences for the people living there, because the only official border crossing between Pakistan and Iran is in the north of the very long border, and Gowarda is right in the south. So there's a lot of, let's say, other effects of this resource extraction that are also coming to play in this area.
I must say this really echoes this story of how livelihoods are dependent upon the oil extraction and the oil trade, and the movement of oil really echoes how livelihoods in, for example, the west coast of Africa that we discussed in previous episodes, where the huge trawlers have nearly emptied the seas and the artisanal fishing becomes extremely difficult, and therefore the fishermen become dependent upon buying bycatch from the bigger trawlers. So there's this similar economy of become dependent upon this kind of wider circulation of goods and extraction that's happening, which is a kind of interesting relationship between different parts of the globe here happening in this context. And maybe that brings us to the question of how this project is also considering how this is a part of a wider infrastructure of extraction. I think you've already talked about this in a way, but maybe if you have something to add about how this sits within the wider infrastructure of extraction through this megaport and the oil and migration also as an infrastructure of extraction.
Well, project, as I said, follows the route from Pakistan towards Europe. And so recently, in the last year or so, we've started working also on the Iran-Turkey border. So particularly near Lake Van, in the city of Van. So just north of that is where a lot of people will cross into Turkey. And one of the things, you know, when we went there, what was really interesting for us was that this particular border area was so similar to where we'd been working in Gwadar, both in terms of the fact that Gwadar is in the Balochistan province of Pakistan, which has been fighting for independence from Pakistan. There have been a few insurgencies, one that was just brutally crushed by the Pakistani military quite recently. And of course, in the area in Turkey where we're working, there's the Kurdish question. So similar, let's say, political context. At the same time, the landscape is quite similar, mountainous, dry. And then, of course, in Turkey, in that particular area, there was also oil smuggling that was happening from Iran. That's now more or less been stopped in that particular area, but a similar sort of, you know, setup where people's livelihoods depended on this trade that has been stopped. So in many ways, if we look at that area of Turkey, we can see perhaps what might happen in Gwadar if the trade is stopped. So I think, you know, these infrastructures of extraction produce very similar geographies, very similar conditions that people have to live with and cope with. So in that sense, working across these two spaces, we hope that we can find a way to even connect communities across these spaces who are living through very similar conditions, actually, and perhaps can learn from each other.
One of the things I thought would be also interesting to talk about is thinking about how Topological Atlas is also really invested in not simply modes of knowledge production, but also how this knowledge is represented. You spoke earlier about how you're also invested in a counter-narrative of the arrows flowing into Europe. As we know, there's very little migration going towards Europe. More than 80% is going in other directions in the global south. And so part of this project is about debunking this myth, but also in thinking about how to represent these different modes of knowledge and circulation. And you've also conducted workshops thinking about how to map these spaces in a way that takes these complexities into consideration, and also thinking about the fictions that are created with the bureaucratic apparatus that you also mentioned, and thinking about how local knowledges and narratives may create a very different picture. But also, of course, a part of that is the non-modern ontologies that are modulating these narratives as a mesh or as a backdrop to these spaces as well. It would be really great if you could say a few words about how these non-modern ontologies are entangled within these shores and how you've been working with mapping or counter-mapping to create a different image of these spaces. And I think maybe image is not the right word here. Well, maybe you could tell me maybe what the right word would be rather than create image of these spaces.
So yeah, we've been working with maps and map making and visual methods, let's say, in all the work that we've been doing. And I suppose one of the, let's say, contradictions in this project is that when we're doing field work, when we're doing research in a place like Gwadar, as you say, there are different ontologies playing out, non-modern, as you named them. And in order to sort of think with those kinds of ways of understanding place, you know, we've been using maps, which are, of course, you know, have a colonial legacy. They have a particular top-down view. So we've been trying to see how we can use this in a more open way. So we've been working with this group called Large Birth, who's based, who's a nonprofit group in Pakistan that we sort of do a lot of our field research with. And I'll tell you a story. So when we started our workshops, what we did was that we made a big tracing of the peninsula that Gwadar sits on. And it's very distinctive. It's a hammerhead peninsula. So it has this very distinctive shape. And with a black pen, we just kind of marked it out. And then every conversation we had with the fisher folk, with others, it was around this particular piece of paper. And what we saw was that every mark that the fisher folk especially made on that piece of paper questioned this big, thick line that we had drawn, this kind of line between land and sea that we thought was, you know, okay, we won't put anything else on, but we need to make the shape of the land. You know, whether it was to do with how the kind of shoreline changed through different seasons, whether it was the fact that their stories would move across land and sea without really making a difference between them. So that was one, let's say, you know, quite obvious thing that we understood, that, you know, we needed a different point of view here. But then also just when we were talking, you know, things would come up like this question of jinns. So if we want to describe what jinns are in a modern ontology, we could say that jinns live in a parallel world. But for those of us who are from sort of Muslim backgrounds, we know of jinns. Jinns live with us. They're here in the room with me now. So they are part of an Islamic understanding of the world, but one that comes in, let's say they're recognized in Islam, but they're actually based on older cosmologies. And so are part of the folklore of each of the places where we talk about jinns. So a jinn in Egypt is very different from a jinn in Pakistan. And so when we were speaking about the places that were important to the people we were discussing with, you know, they would speak about the fact that in this tree a jinn lives, and therefore this tree is important and certain kinds of things happen here. And so the kinds of maps that are made, which sort of parcel off and cordon off land for the use of the port or for certain kinds of developments, of course, don't take into account the fact that this tree that looks like a, you know, a little sort of slightly dried twig because it's on the coast and it doesn't have huge leaves or anything like that, that tree is incredibly important. And at the same time, in Gwadar especially, there are, well, in all of that area, this kind of, especially the southern area of Pakistan, there are lots of shrines everywhere because saints are incredibly important. So Hazrat Khizr, who is the saint of the sea, is really crucial in Gwadar, of course, because people are always going to the sea to fish. And so the saints often have something called a batuk. Batuk is, it can be a little room, it can be a place, but it's a place where the saint will come and visit. And so you go there, make offerings, just sit and contemplate. These are incredibly important spaces. So one of the batuks of Hazrat Khizr is actually in the area of the Gwadar port that has now been cordoned off. And even people, let's say, from Pakistan who live in the big cities do not understand what a catastrophe this is for the people who live there. So it's these kinds of understandings of place that I think get edited out of the kind of maps that we make. So we've been doing a lot of these kinds of mapping, trying to understand those spaces that are not, you know, that won't appear in Google Maps, that won't appear in official kinds of maps. But the other thing I suppose I wanted to say here was the slight contradiction in the project between these kinds of maps that we're making by hand and trying to understand the places that are important to the people we're speaking with, and then our desire to use essentially digital mapping techniques. And the reason for that is that, of course, the border is produced through digital technologies. And so if we're talking about migration and borders and resources extraction, I don't think we can elide the digital. Somehow we need to work with and through the production of borders and space through digital technologies. And so we've been working with a group called Atelier Cartographique in Brussels, with whom we're trying to make a digital mapping platform that does not use Google Maps or OpenStreetMap as a base. So we're starting really from the database, from the categorizations that are hidden within database structures, to try to think, you know, what would be a kind of mapping of these areas that doesn't fit into the categorizations of the border regime. And so let's see what happens with that. But it's literally starting with the database and going forward. But the mapping platform that we're trying to make is essentially an archive that will have, you know, some of the maps that we've made with the Mahigir and in Gawadar. It will have other maps that we have made, to hopefully through the platform you can navigate in particular ways to tell particular stories. So it's definitely a platform that's led by stories and tries to break the kind of given categorizations of mapping, let's say, of digital mapping.
I think it's really important how you are also working at this tension between, let's say, the digital that represents, of course, the kind of ontology of the Enlightenment and these non-modern ontologies. Because, of course, as you say earlier, these border securitization technologies are creating, of course, through remote sensing, they are themselves modulating that space, which is also imbued with non-modern ontologies. These are entangled in a way that is impossible to separate now. And so I think it's really important the way in which you're working to try and think about those tensions and how to maybe work within that, and also to create resources for people to be able to navigate those spaces differently as well. On that note, thank you so much for speaking about Topological Atlas and this really important work. It's been really fantastic.
Thank you for the invitation.
Eurovision was commissioned by Arts Catalyst and Radar and developed in collaboration with the Istanbul Design Biennale. Eurovision has been generously supported by the Canada Council for the Arts, Arts Council England, and Action Culturelle Española.